All right. Welcome to the show. I'm running behind schedule here. I mean, I started the show on time, music-wise and everything, but I ain't ready, god dang it. No. All right. Coming up on the show today, Mike Swanson's going to be back. We're kind of doing a series, I guess, you could say. On his great book, The War State, The Rise of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite After World War II. It's about how everything is screwed up and how it ain't gotta be. Now I'm reading about the Bay of Pigs right now. I keep putting off finishing it because I want to be fresh on the material as we go through the series of interviews here. And, yeah, anyway. So that'll be good. I like talking about history. I like listening to Mike Swanson talk about history. I really think you guys should check out this book. It's a good one. And it's for everybody. It's for people who are experts in this stuff. And it's also for people who are not. But if you want to know why America is all screwed up, what? Yeah, it's The War State. Which happens to also be the name of the book. Anyway, the great Mike Swanson, he will be back on the show about an hour from now. Now, it's possible in the next little while we're going to hear back from Francis Nesbitt. I thought I recognized that name. Then I Googled it, and it turned out I interviewed him 2 years ago. Well, he wrote this hell of a great thing about Al-Shabaab in Somalia for Foreign Policy in Focus. And, well, I couldn't recommend it to antiwar.com because it ends with a call for American intervention on some level. But I don't care anyway. It's so informative that it's worth reading for sure. And I was trying to get him back on the show. I sent him an email. But I will, at the very least, if I don't hear from him by the bottom of the hour, I'm going to go ahead and talk to you about his article anyway, because it's really good. Or, I guess, who knows, I don't know, maybe I'll save it till tomorrow and keep trying to get a hold of the guy. Hey, look, Glenn Greenwald's live on CNN right now. Let's listen.
What we did here was actually about mass bulk spying of Brazilians, tens of millions of emails and telephone calls that are being collected by the NSA regarding innocent people. And we then followed it up with the story about targeting their president for spying, the democratically elected ally of the United States, the oil giant Petrobras, and then conferences designed to negotiate economic conferences. And so as a journalist, my question is not, how can I best help the U.S. government? My question is, how do I inform people around the world of the things they should know? And that's what's being achieved by this story.
Do you make judgments about what is really worth putting out there and what isn't? I mean, certainly there, you know, is an enormous amount. I mean, some have called it a digital dump. There's an enormous amount going out there. And everybody knows, as I said, that leaders are routinely spying on each other and spied upon, even amongst allies.
Well, first of all, you answered your own question the way you asked it, because, of course, you're exactly right that there's a huge amount of documents that Mr. Snowden downloaded and provided to journalists, and then he asked us repeatedly to be very scrutinizing and judicious about going through the documents and weighing each one for what is in the public interest and which ones would result in harm to innocent people. And we have many, 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 many thousands of documents that we've had for 5 months now. And I think we've published a grand total of something like 200 or 250 documents, which shows just how extremely careful we're being. Secondly, it is not true that every country intercepts the personal communications of their democratically elected allies. And it's definitely not the case that every country mass bulk collects the communications of millions of innocent people in virtually every country around the world. It's only the United States that's doing that, and probably only the U.S. and China engaged in this massive economic espionage. And it's something that the world didn't know, and now they do know, and that's the reason why U.S. officials are so angry, not because it damaged national security, but because it damages their reputation and credibility around the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know that U.S. Ambassador Albright or Secretary of State was spied upon the French. So there is a lot of knowledge about spying amongst leaders. But about your issue, what you just said now, American officials are pretty angry. Obviously, you know, you just heard what Mike Morrell said. He called what
I just cannot stand her anymore. I can't even stand the setup question. Anyway, I don't know. I got a problem with what he just said there. He's got 25,000 documents. He's published a couple of hundred so far. How long is this supposed to take? And how many of those documents actually would just get innocent people killed if he released them now, or hurt, or whatever? Would compromise sources and methods in such a way that justifiable government programs would have to be ceased on some level? How much damage would it really be if he released it all right now to Julian Assange on WikiLeaks.org? And how would that damage, how severe would it have to be to outweigh the value in the people of the world learning all of that stuff right now? I mean, I understand that Glenn Greenwald is going to always be on the defensive from people like Christian Amanpour saying, oh, when, how come you're releasing it all? And so then he gets to say over and over and over again, no, I'm releasing just a little bit, really slowly. But, you know, I don't know, man, hurry. This is what I think about that. I think that Chris Floyd made a really good point. That this is becoming like the torture debate in the Bush years, where it started out where even the most right-wing warmongers were saying, whoa, torture? Well, we don't torture. Why? That's why we wage war in the world, to stop torturers, you know, like Saddam Hussein. That was one of the excuses for our invasion. But then after a few months, the argument was, well, you know, the thing of it is it's just an enhanced interrogation, and these guys are terrorists, and they're really bad guys, and they would want to kill the women and children that you care about in your life if we didn't torture them. And so it eventually all ended up being normalized, basically. It's a debatable issue. Some people are against it, but some people are not. You know, that kind of thing. And Chris Floyd wrote this thing at Empire Burlesque. I should have Chris Floyd on the show. But he wrote a thing about how this is becoming a problem because, you know, if you take all the stories since the original Snowden leaks about the Verizon collecting of the metadata, and you take just what's been released so far, if all of that had come out at once, yeah, it would have been a lot to sort through. It would have been a little bit overwhelming, but I think that probably would have been beneficial for it to be overwhelming. Like, holy moly, did you guys hear about this new NSA thing? And instead, what's happened is it ends up being normalized because once the first story came out, then everybody just assumed, oh, okay, well, what, I mean, the regular people of the world of America just assume, okay, yeah, well, total surveillance. Okay, that was the story that he broke. They're collecting everything. Never mind the details. They're collecting everything. So then every story that's come out since then comes with this sort of tale, this little tagline. We already knew that. They're collecting everything. Didn't you already tell us they're collecting everything? So now you're telling us they're collecting everything 700 different ways. But they're collecting everything is the thing. But it just seems to me like it would have been a more powerful story. Maybe, well, like, for example, the Congress, Justin Amash, tried to pass this thing that was really going to defund the mass surveillance of Americans. That had real teeth in it. That guy Amash, he's not a pretender. He's a real libertarian type. I ain't saying he's perfect, but I'm just saying he ain't fake. And he really meant it. And he went up there and introduced some legislation that got quite a few votes from both parties, but not quite enough. I guess a plurality from both parties. No, I guess not. Plurality from the Republicans and less than a plurality from the Democrats. Anyway, point is, Then, after that, the story came out that, oh, yeah, they've been breaking all their own rules and spying on y'all along. And, yeah, sorry if we didn't make that clear to you that, sort of, yeah. And then after that, a whole bunch of congressmen came out and said, oh, man, if only I had known. Now, I'm not saying you can necessarily take that to the bank just because they say that in their own spinning defense. But, you know, that was part of the argument they were hiding behind when they were voting no on it, the ones who voted no. And they say that they're going to reintroduce some legislation now. And in fact, Jim Sensenbrenner, who was one of the principal authors of the Patriot Act, he didn't write it, put the thing together, I guess, out of 10,000 Justice Department memos on their wish list or whatever. He's now behind an effort to roll this thing back, and I'm not sure how severely, but anyway. And I'm sorry, because I really do like Glenn Greenwald, and I would be letting you hear the audio from this, but it's Christian Amanpour, and I just can barely stand to watch her myself. And I'm afraid that if I play her for you, that you just won't listen at all. And besides, it's over now, so good. I just keep the CNN International on out of the corner of my eye in case something really important blows up. Then, you know, hopefully they'll interrupt and update us. What a waste of a Greenwald interview, huh? I can't get the guy on the show. I used to interview him all the time, you know, but it's a shame to see him on the show, and then he's just got to answer on CNN, and he's just got to answer a bunch of Christian Amanpour questions. Oh, how come you're releasing so much when I know for a fact that you're actually not? Oh, yeah, that's a great way to spend this interview, Christian. Why don't you go bomb Syria some more, lady? All right. So, speaking of NSA stuff, I do have some NSA stuff to talk about here. First of all, they had a giant successful rally in Washington, D.C. I don't know how giant, a few thousand, a couple of thousand, according to MSNBC here. It was as if the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street had clasped hands. See, I think regardless of what you think about, or, you know, if you identify with either of those sides or one slightly more than the other, if at all, for either or what, or neither at all, or anything. It seems to me worth pointing out that at least in theory, the Tea Party on the right and the Occupy Wall Street on the left, what that represents is the people who don't have power. The people who fit somewhere on the right or the left, they feel that way, particularly on cultural issues and stuff like that. But they're people who work for a living or wish they did. Not people who are zillionaires and corporate heads and, you know, rent-seeking welfare whores. They're just the regular people. And so, of course, you have the leadership of both parties, the leadership of the entire establishment, all of them. They are all for this NSA stuff. Go right ahead. Whatever. Freedom? Whoever heard of that? That's some old nonsense. Haven't you heard that FDR came to town and changed all that? Got a new freedom now, dude. But it's the regular people. That's who's being, you know, sort of, kind of, pseudo, they wish, anyway, represented by the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, you know? That's what this means. It's Tea Party means Republican voters, or, you know, pseudo could be Republican voters. And that's the same thing for Occupy Wall Street for the Democrats. You know, doesn't mean the ones who decide, means the ones who are saying, hey, stop that. You guys are acting like those guys. Knock it off. And of course, it's always funny if you're a libertarian to see how people on the right define, well, a lot of times, depends on who you ask if they're thinking about whatever, but I've certainly seen political spectrums that have total freedom on the right. And total totalitarian slavery. Yeah, total totalitarianism. That's what I meant to say. complete authoritarian slavery on the left and freedom all the way on the right. And then, of course, leftists see it the other way around. No. All the way, personal autonomy and anarchy is all the way on the left. And authoritarian, fascist, whatever is all the way, totalitarianism is on the right. And they both have their arguments. But as I like to point out, in America anyway, most, not all, but most of the worst horrific government violence doesn't really come from the policies of either extreme or even of the people of either side, but the bipartisan establishment consensus where John Kerry and John McCain agree who ought to be poisoned, who ought to be bombed, who ought to be starved, and who ought to be able to reach their hand into the treasury and take whatever they want. And there's a lot of consensus about those things, you know. But, so, I like it, man. If you're going to have a protest in Washington, D.C. against the National Security Agency, I think it's great to see the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street playing nice and getting along. Stop watching us. ACLU and the Freedom Works behind them both. Libertarian-leaning rightist types. And there you go. Some of the protesters had Occupy Wall Street or Free Bradley Manning. Young Americans for Liberty were there in force. Code Pink was there. And you know what's funny is, remember we talked about last week on the show, there was some jerk wrote this thing at Salon.com saying that liberals should not go protest the NSA if it means having to protest it with libertarians because of how evil libertarians are. Well, apparently that backfired. And a lot of people said, shut up, you're stupid. You know, in effect, with their feet, they said that. And they walked down there and protested anyway. Either that or they just, ever since Glenn Greenwald left Salon.com, they haven't been back and didn't know that anybody wrote something so stupid for Salon.com. But anyway, I'm very happy to hear that, Dennis Kucinich was there. That's good. And Justin Amash. And so I don't know, how much difference it's going to make, but I think that the window for pushing back against NSA spying is, if it's even still open, it's closing rapidly. We need Greenwald. He keeps saying that the worst is yet to come. Well, all right, then, come on with it. It's now time for another one of these holy crap kind of a bombshells here. Because I don't really care about tapping Merkel's phone. I mean, whatever, I'm happy that the Germans know or whatever. I don't mind. I'm just saying, you know, give me something shocking for the American people to make this thing matter again. Let's see. Oh, yeah. And by the way, especially, I guess I could add, before it's too late. Oh, it's Tuesday. Tomorrow they're going to introduce the legislation, by the way. Before it's too late, here's the NSA chief. I'm sure you guys saw this, right? Keith Alexander, General Keith Alexander. That's right, the National Security Agency is part of the military. Sort of kind of outside the Pentagon, but yeah, it's the military spying on you, guys and gals. Anyway, General Alexander did this long interview. It's basically like a big PR stunt with the Pentagon's Armed with Science blog, where, you know, they were there to just be his foil and let him talk. And he talked about how the government should stop the journalism in progress before it's too late. He's not sure what should be done, but something should be done to stop Glenn Greenwald from publishing. Doesn't say him by name, but to stop Laura Poitras from making her film, he thinks. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. I figure if I gotta have a slogan, it's gonna sound something like that. You like it? That's my slogan. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. I'm headed over to scotthorton.org. That's my website. I'm not really an organization, but somebody else owns .com, so what am I supposed to do about it? And I'm going to scotthorton.org/chat. That a ways, I can hang out with the people in there. I hate these captions. They're so hard to read. I'm not a computer. I'm organic material here, but I'm squinting. Just fill out your name and a caption. CAPTCHA. A fake name. Whatever name you want. And a CAPTCHA, and you're in the chat room there. You don't need any external applications. No ChatZilla or XChat or Pigeon. Just plain old browser window, scotthorton.org/chat. Join up and say hi to the boys and girls. Is this thing on? Am I working there? All right. Hey, guys. All right. Hey, I sent a bunch of new stickers off to Rick McGinnis last night. So now I think it's time to go check and see whether he's posted them yet. Because, see, my problem was that I had Illustrator, but it broke. I needed it fixed. So it's fixed now, and I see some new ones, but these aren't mine. These are all somebody else's. I guess they're okay. I like them. They're good ones. Most recent one of mine up there is Benjamin Netanyahu, and it says, "Swiper, no swiping!" Apparently, that's all you have to do is just tell him to stop, and he'll stop. You just have to try it once. Anyway, so I sent in some new ones, including Live and Let Live, you pushy jerk, and a couple more, so anyway. If you like things that I might put on vinyl, then you'll like LibertyStickers.com. Not all of them are made up by me, but a lot of them are. All right. Iraq. Horrible, bloody, deadly violence. And I guess thank goodness the Americans aren't in the middle of it anymore, but it's ugly. 88 people killed and 203 more wounded in a series of coordinated bombings in Baghdad. And also other bloodshed. Series of apparently unrelated attacks in Mosul, while other towns experienced the usual background violence. The background violence. And that's a, you know, an appropriate approximation. That's the great Margaret Griffiths. At original.antiwar.com/update, still keeping track of Iraq violence. 10 years after the invasion. 10 and a half. Thank goodness that George Bush signed that deal to cut and run from there, finally. And that Obama more or less abided by it. But anyway, I just thought you should know, in case, just in case, and I'm not trying to be, you know, too crude about it or cruel, but just in case you ever had said, no, you can't cut and run from there. No, we can't leave now. It'll get worse. Oh, so what if they haven't found the weapons of mass destruction? It's only been 6 months. They need more time. Just wait. Probably 20 years from now, Iraq is going to be awesome because of this. And it'll be worth it. If you said any of those things, you were wrong. Horribly, terribly wrong. The longer the U.S. stayed, the worse it got. All the way through an entire giant sectarian civil war that America caused. And then helped the majority win. So at least that made it more or less permanent, I guess. I'm not saying that the minority had the right to oppress them. I'm just saying American intervention and doing the overthrowing, bad idea. Bad idea. And refusing to cut and run. Like, something is so bad about cutting and running. Somebody call you names, cutter and runner. Oh, I heard you cut and run from something. Yeah, well, whatever. At least I didn't get blowed up because I ran first before I could, so... That's usually my preference, you know, avoiding the violence. Libya is a mess. Oh, and you know what? I meant to get this guy on the show. This is going on the interview this guy list. Let me write him down here. Will Crisp. Will Crisp at CS Monitor, the Christian Science Monitor. In Libya, militias call the government's shots. So, I'm sorry to highlight this. I only bring it to your attention so that you can learn the lesson that intervening in Libya was a bad idea. We better stop it now and let these things sort themselves out their own way. Because I would hate for any attention that I brought to Libya to end up just blowing back in everyone's face and ending up just, you know... lending a prop basically to the Lindsey Grahams of the world, who would say, you know, Scott Horton is right that things in Libya aren't going too good and we owe those people of Libya a better future, so let's go deliver it to them because they love it, right? I mean, when Patrick Coburn said, man, the hypocrisy of the American media just closing their eyes to Libya and just let's never talk about Libya again after cheerleading that war and turning the place to chaos. It's horrible. And I says, I gotta prefer it. I'm sorry. Let's just go ahead and keep ignoring Libya. It's the same thing like with Syria. And the American people responded to Obama's call to go save the Syrians by bombing them. And the American people's answer was, we don't care enough about the Syrians to bomb them. Screw them. Let them all get chemical weaponed to death. See if we give a crap. And I have to say, okay, fine, good. Yeah, exactly. Right? I mean, what are you going to do? Settle. This is how Americans make peace. It's going to have to be good enough. What? Libya? Syria? Never heard of them? Don't care. Don't bomb them because that whole thing smacks of effort. All right. More talking after this. Talking. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott.
All right, I know I got to change up the bumper music on the show. Well, I've been busy. Actually, though, you know, the laptop that plays the music, it used to have this thing where it had to be plugged in all the time. But I think it got over that, and now the battery works again, mysteriously. So maybe I could take it with me somewhere, and I could muck around with the music on it. Fix that up for you. Nobody wants to hear the same old thing. All right. Well, anyway. Mike Swanson's coming up on the show to talk about his great book, The War State. And this is only part one. I think it's going to be a three-parter. Let me see. Three parts? Yeah, this is just from the end of World War II through Kennedy. Great stuff. Very important history here. And written by a libertarian, which I gotta prefer because I don't want to hear a bunch of crap about the true wonderfulness of democracy and the true inherent predatory nature of capitalism and this and that, because actually I see it the other way around. Well, I mean, to oversimplify it. Vastly oversimplified, but yeah. Anyway, so it's nice to read some good revisionist history from a libertarian point of view. And especially about militarism, you know? Anyway, Jacob Hornberger, his thing too is the national security state. And I think it's interesting. I always like to point out about Gareth Porter, who you guys know is my favorite lie debunker journalist who I ever have on this show. And I have him on quite often. His thing, he's a leftist. And I don't know how far out of a leftist he really is. I mean, mostly he's just a national security beat reporter. But I think, you know, his principles are progressive or whatever, right? He ain't like some commie. But, you know, he's a progressive. But he doesn't blame capitalism for militarism in America. He doesn't blame the oil companies. He doesn't blame the bankers. He doesn't blame Raytheon and arms merchants. He doesn't let them get off scot-free or anything. But he's just saying that's not where it's at. You know where it's at? The Pentagon. The generals themselves. The job holders in the military bureaucracy. How many admirals we got? Yeah, exactly. I don't know either, but we all know way more than we really need. Because they're just a bunch of welfare whores. That's all they are. Oh, I know. They wear such fancy jackets. Scott, how can you call a man in such a fancy jacket a whore? Well, let's see. He sucks taxpayer money out of the wallets of hardworking free individuals, right? When he's bright and capable enough to get by on his own, presumably. I don't know. I'm really impressed by the spiffy nature of the jacket still. I hear your argument. They wear very nice jackets. In fact, in the interview with his own little sock puppet there, General Alexander is wearing this thing that it's supposed to, I think, approximate some sort of civilian coat because it doesn't have all the medals on the front. Ah, but he's still got all the stars on his shoulders. Very fancy. Now, do you think a guy like that wants to give up the fancy little stars on his shoulders? Yeah, I don't think so. And of course, you know, the fancy stars come with massive perks, private golf courses and jets, and power, and a cushy retirement as a contractor working for SIAC or Raytheon or whatever when he's done, when they're all done. It's the biggest honeypot in the history of the world. And think of it like this. World War II, just take it for granted. Every American myth you were ever sold up through and including World War II is just freaking great. All of it. Never mind revising any of your understanding of any of that. But just can't you see how? After World War II, a bunch of guys with some factories cranking out weapons wanted to keep selling weapons to the Pentagon. Because why stop? What am I going to do? Make widgets that people in the market may or may not want to buy? Why would I do that when I can just bribe some generals to give me all their money that they get for free? Right? Or even, what if it was all great through, like, Reagan? Say, like, you worship Reagan because for some reason you worship Reagan. Okay, but then after that, guess what? Some businessmen figured out they can make some money selling stuff to the Pentagon. You see, I'm just trying to make it easy for you to accept the truth of it is all, you know, because it's such a contrary point of view. It's like, you know, I'm trying to take it away from a mythical time that you're emotionally attached to. What if Bill Clinton was the one who made the oversights? And he was just so busy chasing tail around the West Wing, or the East Wing, or whichever wing is which, that he let some businessmen end up gaining some influence over the way that the Pentagon operates. Could you believe that? could you believe that it happened generations ago? And that, like, I'm sorry if I'm abusing and overusing this, but it's the best that my brain can do, okay? Like Doc Brown and the chalkboard. Askew to a tangent, to a false alternate reality where everything is not how it's supposed to be. Because the entire economy, the entire society is geared toward this unnecessary militarism. That's why people are dead, and that's why people are out of work, and that's why the smartest people design weapons instead of modern distribution networks for, you know, food and blankets. Anyway, it's all true. Oh my God. Ike Eisenhower, that noted communist radical, was right. The corporations and the Pentagon, they're in on it together. They're all making a bunch of money. Whichever one you hate the most corrupted the other, if you want. And they kill people every day. They kill them. And look, I was raised just like you. Everybody's raised the same way. Especially, I don't know if it was like this before World War II, but certainly since World War II. Well, I don't know. Maybe I am only speaking for myself and not anyone else. But in my life, I learned that there is a government exception to the whichever third commandment or whichever it is from God, you know, the creator of the entire universe, that says you're not allowed to kill each other. He says you are not allowed to kill each other, etched in stone from thousands of years ago. But no, it turns out that there was a government invented just a couple of hundred years ago, and that if it dresses you up in green and tells you to kill somebody, you know, like that one time that America took on the Nazis, then that's okay. God doesn't mind that. He won't send you to hell for that, because that's the government employment exception. Or better, that's the fighting Nazis exception to the commandment of God that you can't kill people. And what's funny about all that is how, you know, hey, as long as it's all metaphysical and whatever, it's not like you can quantify it. Does the shade of green of the camouflage matter? Or what if the army doesn't fill out all the proper paperwork when they induct you? Or it just gets lost somewhere and misfiled, you know? I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be that funny or anything. I guess I'm not being that funny. I can't hear anyone laughing anyway except myself. But yeah, no, it turns out killing people's wrong. And yeah, you could come up with an argument that there are a bunch of enemies against the United States out there in the world, but then I would have to point out that that's just not really true. And that really, you already know that too, so. Well, come on, Scott, there's got to be dozens of terrorists who are willing to come here and kill Americans. Yeah? In order to what? To get us to stop killing them? I mean, yeah, they're trying to get us to overreact and invade their territory to bleed our country to bankruptcy. But why? Because we're the sleeping giant over here minding our own business? Or because, like they said, we are already at war with them through their own tyrannies. Their own tyrannies. The ones that we support that claim to own them. And they figured, well, let's go ahead. We can't overthrow our local dictators as long as Uncle Sam is backing them. So let's bait the Americans into a full-scale invasion of the region, break the bank, that biggest honeypot in the history of the world, break it, bankrupt them, and force their empire all the way out. If our government wasn't over there killing people in the first place, they would have no reason to try to bait us into invading. And yeah, they wanted us to invade over there. That was the whole thing. The overreaction. As Will Grigg could have told you back in the fall of 2001. That's where I read it, was in the New American Magazine of the John Birchers. And I'm not the biggest fan of the John Birchers, certainly like back in history when they had everything way whack. And in fact, well, who knows? But I love Will Grigg, and especially since he left the John Birchers, which was a long time ago now.
He's awesome now over at the Pro Libertate blog, but he was always my favorite back when he was with the John Birchers anyway. And I'm not a cultural issues guy, as you guys know, so that wasn't my point. My thing was the foreign policy, you know. But anyway, right after September 11th, Will Grigg wrote a thing. He wrote a bunch of things. But one of them said, hey, listen, if you paid any attention to left-wing radicals over the years, then you understand about terrorism that they're trying to get you to be stupid. They're trying to get you to overreact. Because they are weak. It's asymmetric warfare. It's just, you know, it's, come on, it's the third grade definition of judo. You know, use their own weight against them. Any child can understand this principle. You know, how to flip someone over if they're coming at you. Or slam them into the wall or whatever. Little kids can do it if you teach them right. Use their power against them. So what you're supposed to do is be smart. And maybe being tough would have, you know, would be part of being smart, but not necessarily. And anyway, the action is in the reaction is all I was trying to say. To get you to screw yourself up. But, you know, that was a tangent too, wasn't it? The terror war. I was comparing that to something else, but then I need to start drinking. Because use that alcohol to rinse all the resin out of my brain, you know? Hey, here's something you already knew. Jack Straw says that AIPAC is the biggest barrier to peace in the world, right? Not the Likud government of Israel, even, according to Jack Straw. But no, the Israeli government's lobby in the United States. Well, what could he possibly mean by that? Their unlimited funding, he says. Quote-unquote, unlimited funds available to Jewish organizations and the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee in the U.S., which are used to control American policy in the Middle East. And the American policy has helped the worst of Israeli policy continue on indefinitely. And, of course, what does he really mean by that? What he really means by that is AIPAC can let virtually any of 435 congressional representatives know that their goose is cooked unless they go along. Simple as that. We'll run someone against you in your next primary. Oh, you're a one-term congressman, but you want to be a seven-term congressman? Retire rich someday? You better go along with Israel. Or you will go nowhere. And that's all it is. And what's funny is, if the... we're sick and tired of Israel lobby in America could get their act together and really get everybody, you know, donating money and, playing that political game, they could win it. I'm not really into playing that political game myself, so it's easy for me to talk. But I'm just saying they're just better at it. They're dedicated and they participate in the democracy and the squeaky wheel gets the grease. That's the name of the game. Complain the most loudest. And make sure and never forget, right? Keep it in your database that, hey, Congressman, what's his name? Went along with AIPAC instead of us this time. Or, you know, that one time, you know, a year and a half ago. Let's get him. And then, you know, they can always find somebody to run to. And also, they can just deny you funds. They get everybody, every congressman in America, relying on their campaign funds in the first place. They can do a hell of a lot of damage just by withholding them, just by threatening to. As Steve Rosen, who was one time the director of AIPAC, also one time indicted for espionage and was guilty as hell. He just got away because of politics. But anyway, he one time told Jeffrey Goldberg, Netanyahu's secret agent at The Atlantic, then for The New Yorker, he said, you see this napkin? They were at a bar at a hotel, you understand. You see this napkin? By this time tomorrow, I could have the signature of 77 senators on this napkin. Of course, the point being, doesn't matter what the subject is. They'll do whatever I tell them. What's interesting is that, of
course, Jack Straw is one, what, like the fourth or fifth worst person on the face of the planet, so he should go and screw himself. But the other thing is that it's interesting to me that, at least in this statement that they're quoting, or in this article, I mean, in the foreword, they're accusing him of being an anti-Semite. Oh, I'm surprised he neglected to mention Jewish control of the media. Well, come on, like, the American media isn't friendly to Zionism or something? But anyway, oh yeah, Jack Straw. All of a sudden, we just found out that, never mind that he's a Stalinist, and never mind that he went along with Israel's plan for an American-British regime change in Iraq while he was the foreign secretary of the Great Britain. No, I guess we just realized all of a sudden, now he's retiring and had one bad cross thing to say about the Israel lobby in America, that he's some kind of Nazi. You hear that? I'm surprised he didn't bring up the Protocols of Zion. That's right. Because anyone who notices that the state of Israel is a pain in the state of America and the state of Great Britain's rear end, what they really mean is they just hate Jews, obviously, right? That's what Annette Wilf says. That's a member of the Israeli Knesset. I don't know. They don't say he or she articles in here. Oh, her. Yes, her. Annette Wilf says, oh, that Jack Straw, I guess we just all of a sudden found out that he's a bigot. That must be his problem. Who ever heard of an honest critic of the power of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee? There aren't any. And I promised I would talk to you about this, and sorry for forgetting what the hell I was talking about before, but I probably had already said so much brilliant stuff about it before I lost my train of thought that it doesn't even matter anyway, right? Either that, or probably so many people had quit listening by then that it didn't even matter anyway, or for some other reason that I haven't come up with yet, it didn't even matter. Really need to start having lunch before the show. Where's this Al-Shabaab? Listen, this guy, I remember that he was a smart guy. I don't remember what all we talked about. I want to go back and listen to my old interview of him, I guess. But I interviewed him one time before, and here he is at Foreign Policy in Focus. His name is Francis Nesbitt. Francis Njubi. Njubi? I guess the N must be silent, right? Is it just Jubi? Or is it newbie and the J is silent? In either case, Francis Nesbitt wrote this thing for Foreign Policy in Focus. And it's all about Somalia. And I learned some things in here. Especially he's saying that the fact of the raid on the mall in Kenya is proof that the internationalist, more Al-Qaeda-like faction of Al-Shabaab now, in 2013, in the future come true, has finally won out over the more nationalist faction. And the way he says it, the American rapper guy that got killed, he was the more interested in fighting for Somali nationalism and against the internationalism. And, or I don't know if that guy's problem was the internationalism, but part of his problem was the excesses of the more extremist, cut your hands off, cut your head off, stone your wife to death type, you know, really crazy, hardcore Islamist, which, you know, it's a pretty alien situation in Somalia to have that kind of thing. Anyway, the people who are trying to stop them, they have lost out. And now the more, quote-unquote, extreme faction has taken power. And they're not just more Islamist, they're more internationalist. And what's his name? Their leader has sworn his allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri. Here, hang on. Let me find his name here. Good old what's his name is not going to suffice for this, Scott. You're going to have to do better than that. Oh, come on. Okay, how about this? Oh, great. Never mind. Anyway, here's the thing that I really learned that I wanted to get to. Remember when the Kenyan troops basically sacked Kismayo and drove Al-Shabaab out? That was in... Yeah, it was last year. I wasn't certain for a second there. And you might remember at the time we mocked them on the show because they were saying it was a McClatchy story where the officials were saying that, oh yeah, see our great victory. Al-Shabaab, they're on the run now. Boy, we sure have whooped them good. And now there's no more Al-Shabaab anymore because we took Kismayo. And I was laughing at him, and I was saying, yeah, what's fun is never learning anything about anything while you're at war across the world. Because, I mean, you know, the Taliban is about to inherit the government we're leaving behind in Kabul after they fled Kabul 12 years ago. They didn't fight for Kabul, they just left. They're still around, and they're fixing to take it back after all this time. That's how bad the Taliban lost. All they've got to do is not lose. And so, run away, stay alive, you know, lay some landmines, lay down some sniper fire every once in a while, and wait them out. So all the guerrilla has to do is not lose. So Al-Shabaab, all they did was left Kismayo. They didn't fight for Kismayo. They know they're no match for a state's standing army invading a city with armor and money, American money. So they left. They didn't all blow their own brains out, and they didn't all die in some giant, you know, battle they lost. They just left. However, and if you read my wonderful article about this horror story at fff.org, U.S. government to blame for Somalia's misery, you'll notice that I point out that, yes, they sacked Kismayo, but Al-Shabaab just left, and the war continues. I actually am regretting now two things that I didn't point out in the article. I didn't focus on their bombing in Uganda. That was revenge for a Ugandan strike inside Somalia. Remember when they attacked that soccer stadium? I've talked about that on the show a bunch of times and covered it at the time, but I didn't put that in the article. And I should have warned. I mean, I knew at the time I was writing it. I just didn't think to add to the article that, listen, they've already taken revenge across borders in Uganda for Ugandan crimes inside Somalia. And so the possibility remains that they'll go even further afield. I didn't understand as much as this guy whatsoever about the different factions and how dedicated they are to spreading their jihad around and et cetera like that. But here's the big thing that I'm trying to get to. I swear I'm going to get to it presently. And that is that when the Kenyans kicked Al-Shabaab out of Kismayo, that was one of the primary factors in their becoming a much more internationalist group and wanting to export their fight. As Nesbitt puts it here, in 2010, the UN Monitoring Group in Somalia estimated Al-Shabaab was earning over $50 million a year from smuggling and extortion at the port of Kismayo. The group lost this lucrative port last year when Kenyan troops led a successful offensive that expelled the militants. The loss of its major source of funding played no small part in the transformation of Al-Shabaab from a local to a global terrorist organization. Such globalization serves in effect as a fundraising campaign designed to mobilize support from international jihadists who are interested in attacking Western targets in the region. So there you go. And in fact, here, wait a minute. I know some key words. John Glazer, Somalia. Man. Well, that's going to have to be good enough. Let's see. He always has this great quote, and he keeps using it. I sure hope he's got a few different blog entries like this. But he has a great quote from the administration itself. Blam. Yeah, there it is. See, here it is. From the Washington Post. One administration official tells the Washington Post, would have been December 13th, 2011, that there is concern that a broader campaign could turn al-Shabaab from a regional menace into an adversary determined to carry out attacks on U.S. soil. So, that was 2 years ago. They've gone ahead and continued to intervene there. And they've succeeded because, of course, does everybody already know that, of course, Ethiopia, Uganda, Burundi, and Kenya have their governments there, their militaries there under the African Union because America's paying for all of it and directing all of it, period. This is all the American proxy war there, making matters worse for Americans, spreading al-Shabaab terrorism, which they created in the first place. Read my article at fff.org all about it.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Scott Horton Show. And, well, I'm embarrassed because in the last segment there, I spaced out. I was talking about the generals and the war state and how the terrorists are trying to bankrupt us and something. And I forgot what the hell I was saying. And that's because I shouldn't smoke so much weed before the show. Anyway, thanks for bearing with me. The good part of the show is about to start. Our guest is Michael Swanson. He is the author of The War State: The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite, 1945 through 1963. So, in other words, part one. Welcome back to the show. Mike, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me again.
Well, you're welcome. Very happy to have you here. Good book. I've been reading it. I kind of like doing this thing where I interview you kind of segment by segment through the whole book sort of thing because... that way I'm taking my time reading it. I'm getting other things read, too. And anyway, so I really like it. It's good stuff. Now, the problem, if you could say that there's a problem, the problem is the way that I ended the last interview,
with my wacky conspiracy theory about the shoot down of Gary Powers' U-2 jet over the Soviet Union in a way that it scuttled the deal. In fact, they even made an episode of Quantum Leap about this, where Sam Beckett was going to have a chance. I forget whether it worked out or not. I guess not. He was going to have a chance to figure out a way to stop the flight and so that it wouldn't scuttle the talks, and then Ike and Khrushchev were going to make friends, and that would be the end of the Cold War way back in the 1950s instead of at the end of the 1980s. But anyway, and then the music started playing, and I kicked you right off the air, and that was the end of that. So let's start the show with that today. Tell me all you know about that U-2 flight and what you make of it.
Well, the flight occurred right before Khrushchev and Eisenhower are going to have this summit meeting, and both of them were trying to make some sort of deal. They had no, like, plan or anything, but Eisenhower definitely was hoping to take control of the arms race, and Khrushchev was sort of desperate to do it. And the United States was flying, and the CIA were flying these U-2 flights over the Soviet Union and taking pictures. And Eisenhower needed this information because it was going to show him how many nuclear missiles the Soviets had. And he was under criticism by people claiming that he was allowing the Russians to build missiles and there's this missile gap. And none of that was true. So these U-2s are flying over taking pictures. They couldn't find any missiles. And then there was one final spot that they had never taken any pictures of, which happened to be where their rocket facility was. They just, for some reason, the CIA decided, we'll just leave the most important place to last. But they were having this summit, and Eisenhower said, well, let's told the CIA, well, let's cancel these flights. I don't want anything to happen. There's a risk every time that one could get shot down. And the guy running the flights, a fellow named Richard Bissell, he talked him out of it. That's according to declassified CIA history, that he contacted Eisenhower and said, well, let's just do this one flight. And that flight ends up, you know, getting shot down over the Soviet Union. Now, what's thrown a lot of confusion into all this, though, is that there's all these contradictory statements from Eisenhower. Right after he gets shot down, he hopes that, you know, if he just doesn't say anything, maybe the Russians won't say anything either and the summit can just happen. But Khrushchev, he comes under pressure from hardliners in the Soviet Union to respond. So he makes the propaganda thing out of it and reveals that this U-2 plane has been shot down. And then Eisenhower says, well, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't approve these flights. And, you know, I just had nothing to do with it. And, well, he realizes pretty quickly that causes a big problem. That makes it sound like he's not in control of the government. So then he backtracks and says, oh, yeah, I did approve this one flight. So Eisenhower got caught basically telling a lie as a result of this. It may be the first time a president has ever been caught like that, you know, blatantly lying to the whole world.
Why aren't you convinced, though, or why are you convinced that it's not the case that he meant what he said when he said it the first time, then he realized, yeah, I mean, that sounds bad, like he's not really in control of the government, but maybe he really wasn't. Maybe the CIA had screwed him on it.
Well,
I mean, that would be the theory, and I know it's not original,
yeah, sure.
Right? That right-wing forces or whatever kind of forces inside the CIA and the military wanted to keep the thing going forever, and so they didn't want any kind of peace summit at all, and screw Ike if that's what he wants.
Well, the thing is, that's actually what Khrushchev believed, and the evidence for that is in records that have come out over the past 10 years of transcripts of Politburo minutes, which were published in a book, and I use it as a source in here. And when they interrogated Gary Powers, they asked him, the KGB kept asking him, you know, is this a setup? What happened? Was this a done on purpose to sabotage his summit? And he denied that and said, no, you know, you shot it down. And I think it's actually, in the end, it sort of is a murky incident. There's no real evidence to point to either way. But what makes me think that it probably wasn't, something overly sinister is that the CIA history got declassified in the past couple of years, and it was an internal history, and it doesn't have anything like that in it. And you say, well, how can you rely on a CIA history and just believe it? The thing is, the government histories that are released, they don't want to put something that's blatantly not true in them, because that would cause a huge problem with the story, academia, and you just don't want to do that. So they're more likely to just dribble out small bits of information and just blatantly release something that's a total lie.
Well, and that story has been a controversy this whole time, right?
I don't know when the controversy initially started, but yeah, I mean, it is, a lot of people believe it was intentionally sabotaged.
All right, now, go ahead.
I think that the real important thing from it, though, is the interesting thing to me isn't so much whether it was sabotaged or not, but how did the Russians interpret dealing with the United States and dealing with Eisenhower, and how did they, fit this into what they were trying to do? And sabotaged or not, what's interesting is Khrushchev's view of Eisenhower, and he met him before this happened. He came to the United States, and the two met, I think it was in the White House. And the Russians had a positive view of Eisenhower. They thought, they dealt with him during World War II. They thought he was a man of peace. But Khrushchev thought also that he wasn't in full control of the presidency, and that he was surrounded by, the word he used was militaristic forces, and he's probably thinking of John Foster Dulles in particular. He was Eisenhower's Secretary of State, and his brother, of course, was the CIA director. But John Foster Dulles, during the Dien Bien Phu incident or battle in Vietnam, he advocated intervening over there and even potentially using atomic weapons. So it'd be easy for someone like Khrushchev to see him and think, my God, this is what the United States is about, and here's Eisenhower trying to make peace. He's surrounded by these people who are very extreme, and and then here's this mysterious incident.
Well, it seems like if Khrushchev and the KGB were so suspicious that Ike was being set up, it seems like, I guess it just makes it even more too bad that they didn't ignore it and proceed and deal with him and try to, push back.
Well, the real problem with the theory that it's sabotaged is that the Russians, if that's true, if they're really convinced of it, maybe they were, if they're convinced it was sabotaged, they claim they shot it down. So they're claiming it's sabotaged, and then they're claiming they also shot it down. So if it was exploded in the air, they should have said that. They never made that claim. So the Russians...
Bush Jr.'s plan was just fly a U-2 low enough that Saddam could get at it deliberately. It's not hard to imagine. Bush was probably thinking, or somebody was thinking of Powers as the example. I bet at least the accusation over Powers for that one. Remember Option B, the rolling start in the Downing Street memo?
Yeah, what was that?
Oh, yeah, in the Downing Street memo, there's Option 1 is the giant buildup in Kuwait and then invade like they did in March 03. But then there's Option B, rolling start. Let's paint up an American U-2 spy plane in UN colors, and we'll get it, even though he hasn't been able to shoot down a single plane in a dozen years over his own country in the no-fly zones. We'll deliberately get this shot down, and we'll use that as the casus belli. We'll go ahead and start the invasion early and then just get the rest of the army there when we can. Somehow cooler heads prevailed over that plan, but that was, and Bush had proposed that, personally had proposed that to Blair in front of Dearlove, the head of MI6 at the time, and then it was Dearlove Smithers who took the notes.
Good grief. Well, I mean, Joey Match who gave Bush that idea.
Yeah, somebody told him that, but anyway. And I guess, you know, here's the thing about the U2 for me, and I'm sorry because we got to move on from here. There's a lot more important stuff to talk about, too.
Sure.
But I think I learned about this from my dad when I was a little kid, that there was a discrepancy even that he remembered from way back then, which was, and maybe this isn't even a real thing or not. Maybe this has been, you know, debunked as a thing since then. But I just, it was brought up to me as a little kid that if it was really supposed to be that top secret of a CIA deniable op, he wasn't supposed to have a parachute. And the deal was if his plane got shot down, tough, and that he knew that going in because he was that deep of a undercover sort of a dude or whatever, and that the fact that he had a parachute meant that, or seemed to indicate that it was, you know, meant to be a publicity stunt that would undermine the talk, something like that.
I don't know. I do know that he had poison capsules with him, and he was, all these U2 pilots were told if you're shot down, you're supposed to suicide yourself. So you would think they wouldn't give him parachutes to make sure it happened.
Yeah, I mean, how deniable is it supposed to be? I don't know. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So now, tell me again what year Stalin died.
54, 55, I believe it was.
All right. And then, so I believe I read in your book that there were some men in D.C. who thought, hey, let's go ahead and take this opportunity to put some of this brinksmanship to bed and see if we can move on in our relationship from here. And there was a possibility of that for a while. What happened to that? Was that this?
Yeah, well, when Stalin died, the guy that first took over, his name was Malenkov, but then there was an internal struggle, and Khrushchev beat him out. But the key thing, the important thing, though, is that as soon as Stalin died, the Russians released statements to the effect that they wanted a cooling-off period in the Cold War, and then, you know, Eisenhower sort of tried to reciprocate by making a famous speech. It's titled Adams for Peace, in which he, you know, talks about using nuclear technology for more peaceful things and controlling the arms race and so forth. So they made an olive branch to each other, but it basically, you know, got scuttled by this U2 incident. And the Russians were desperate to want to make some sort of deal. They were falling behind in the arms race, but just as important, you know, they had turmoil in Eastern Europe, you know, Czechoslovakia. They had to intervene there and put down a revolt. And Germany was a big problem. There was no Berlin Wall, and East and West Berlin were divided. The U.S. had, the West Berlin was an allied city. East Berlin was part of East Germany. But there was no wall. So what was happening was people were going to West Berlin from the Soviet territories and just leaving, you know. And they're draining away their wealth and people, and this, you know, they wanted some way to fix this. They end up putting the wall later on, but they kept, Khrushchev made a bluff to Eisenhower, threatened war unless we settle to some deal over Berlin. And this props up again and again in the Kennedy presidency, where Berlin becomes this big issue between the two sides, and the Soviets essentially keep trying to run, you know, bluff themselves into forcing the United States into some sort of negotiation because they're in a position of weakness, and the U.S. basically, besides Eisenhower and Kennedy later on, they view the United States as being sort of controlled or that's not the exact way out here. I'll give you the exact phrase Khrushchev uses here. He says, tells the Politburo that the United States' actions are not based on logical principles, because to them, it's logical for the United States to negotiate and control the arms race and the Cold War and so forth. He says, rather, it is governed by different groups and sudden coincidental events. That's why America could easily start a war. Even if it was fully aware, according to military circles, of the fact that the situation could grow worse, that's why certain forces could emerge and find a pretext to start a war against us. In other words, they see the president, Kennedy and Eisenhower, as being someone they hope they can talk to, but also seeing him surrounded by forces that he really has not full control over and are willing to start a war. And then I think that's a fascinating depiction of the United States, because on one hand...
Oh, let's save the one hand and the other hand. We'll be right back with Mike Swanson, author of The War State, right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. We're talking some history here with Michael Swanson, author of The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite, 1945 through 1963. Of course, sponsor of this show, by way of Wall Street Window, their investment advice for you at wallstreetwindow.com. And check out writermichaelswanson.com is how to find the link to the book. Also at my website, scotthorton.org, you can find it right there in the red margin. It's big and it's red and it's got Ike Eisenhower on the front. You can't miss it. The War State. So I'm sorry, Mike, when we were interrupted by the break, you were talking about Khrushchev's view of the United States and how, never even mind the young brash Kennedy, but even Ike Eisenhower, the hero of World War II and all that, was suspected by Khrushchev of being almost powerless in the face of the pressure groups in America who wanted the Cold War to continue at all costs.
Yeah, he makes the statement to the Politburo that when he looks at the United States, what he sees is a strange event that occur by coincidence, almost can't be explained, and then forces that are willing to go to war, even if it's against our own, the United States' interests as a country, that he says they're, the quote, the word he uses is irrational. And I think if you look at all, you know, American history since World War II, you can see examples of that over and over again. I mean, just about every single war we've been involved in, you can find, you know, some weird start of it. You know, the Vietnam War, we have the Gulf of Tonkin incident, the Panama War, when we invaded Panama, there was a story in the LA Times, the reason given was that some Americans were being mistreated, that they went to a border check and were arrested and had mishandled and beaten, I think the story was, and then a story comes out in the LA Times that those details, you know, the other things led up to that, that we were harassing them, in fact. And then you gave this example of Bush's crazy plan and so forth. But there's also forces willing to go to war, and then with the history of the presidency of Kennedy shows that the generals there wanted to go to war over and over again.
Right.
They requested them to send troops to Vietnam, and then, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Then we have the Vietnam War itself, and a lot of this history is kind of, if you really, you know, deep into it, really dig into it, a lot of it is sort of, I don't know if the word's mysterious, but maybe disputed. If you look at the Vietnam War, there's arguments over why did Johnson really escalate the war? And, you know, was it all about him? Was he worried about people saying he's a wimp, essentially, is one argument? Or, you know, was it military pressure, which I think is best summed up in Gareth Porter's book about that. But so anyway, and then you wonder, like, even today, what is really, who's in charge and what's really going on? I mean, if you look at this Syria situation, I don't know what really was going on there. Apparently, Obama decides at the last second to go get a vote after telling the National Security Council he's ready to do these bombing strikes, and he's going to go all of a sudden to Congress, and then he doesn't get it. What does that mean? Does that mean that, you know, he's trying to get out of it by knowing he's going to get rejected, or does that mean he just don't know what he's doing and he's incompetent? I don't know.
I think that, yeah, well, that was what Gareth said, that, you know, if he goes to Congress, that means he's begging for a way out. And, of course, Eric Margolis says, you know, he had sources that told him it's a fact that it was the Russians' idea in the first place about having the Syrians give up the chemicals as the compromise. And then so they staged that whole flub where Kerry accidentally comes up with that idea at a press conference and all this thing, which, you know, I'll take it. But you're right that, I mean, that sure is kind of a crazy thing. If that's the only thing a president can do to get out of a war is to stage that sort of a spectacular failure of his own plan. You know what I mean? I don't know. He's a horrible president. Let's just put it that way. But anyway, so
yeah,
wait, I want to go back a minute to about war being unthinkable or not. Because, look, killing Vietnamese all day is plenty thinkable. Nobody cares about that at all. You know, how many people died in Vietnam? 58,000. Everybody knows that. Nobody cares about the Vietnamese. But or the Koreans or the Iraqis or anything like that. Not the Americans. They don't care. But so nuclear war, though, is different. If you have a war with China or if you have a war with America or, I mean, with the Russians, and that means you're giving up every major city in America, right? And the politicians even giving up their own lives and having nothing but a wasteland. This is why Truman fired MacArthur's, because MacArthur was willing to go ahead and expand the war into China, and Truman thought if you do that, you're going to bring in the Soviets, and we're going to have a nuclear war, and it ain't worth it. So we'll just draw a line at the parallel and call it a day. We'll wait for Eisenhower to do it. But anyway, fire MacArthur over it, wanting to expand the war, because nuclear war is unthinkable, because that means we could die in the thing. And that's what has prevented major power war this whole time, is the fact that it would have to be nuclear. And I think you're certainly right that we've only been saved from it by the skin of our teeth, you know, quite a few times, where it really could have happened anyway. And that's the thing that I really want to get to, is, you know, the consensus, I think, for a long time was we don't really care about war against helpless countries. As long as they can't fight back, we're for it. But you talk about, and you were just mentioning, and you talk about in your book, these people really are not just MacArthur, but there are a lot of people in the government, especially in the 50s and 60s, who were perfectly willing to have a nuclear war. And so, okay, yeah, so we got to trade New York and Denver and Miami and Los Angeles and Dallas. But, you know, anyway, it'll be all right, though. We'll still win or whatever. They don't care. They're willing to have a nuclear holocaust, these guys, the U.S. military.
Well, that's the most shocking thing to me when I did the research for this book, you know, and I think defines the whole era of the time period that this book is talking about. And the thing is, when I, you know, I got a master's degree in history, and that I got in 1989, or 1998, I mean. So it's over 20 years, right? time goes by, about 25 years. So anyway, I'm back then I was reading all these Cold War history books as a graduate student. One of the professors I had at the time, he's on the Council for Foreign Relations, and he wrote back then a revisionist, but one of the most important histories of the Cold War. It still is. And the thing is that I didn't know what you just said until just the last year. And that wasn't in the history of 25 years ago. And the interpretations of the Cold War, the reasons for it, have a... You still there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, it had changed over the years. So, the first revisionist history stuff would basically say, well, who was responsible? The U.S. was responsible, some people would say. And then you get a wave of revisionism that said, no, not really. Both sides were responsible. And I kind of talk about that in the book, too. I kind of take that argument also. But thing is that another argument that's sort of appeared in the past 10 years, which is the newest revisionist argument in academia, is that, well, we always had a great advantage over the Soviet Union, just as, I'm pointing that out in the book. But they'll say that all the Vietnam War, the Korean War, McCarthyism, all this stuff is really partisan politics, and just people trying to make money off of all this stuff, and the two kind of go together. Well, I don't really think that, in the end, that's the real explanation for a lot of this stuff.
And ideology is a big part of it, obviously.
Yeah, sure. Well, the arms race, I think, is really the critical factor for the time of Eisenhower and Kennedy, because what ended up happening was we had such a gigantic advantage over the Soviet Union. There's always these predictions in the 50s, oh, they're going to build nuclear missiles, and Khrushchev talked about, oh, I'm building missiles like sausages and all this kind of stuff, but none of this stuff was true. And so by the time Kennedy was president, the Russians only had four nuclear missiles that could reach the United States, and their bombers couldn't fly here and go back, and they only had something like a dozen or two dozen of them, while we had about 100 nuclear missiles, and we're building more and more and more. So in 1961, there's a crisis over Berlin again, where after the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy and Khrushchev has this famous summit, and Khrushchev gives him an ultimatum, if we don't settle Berlin, there could be a war, and Kennedy, leaves saying, well, it's going to be a cold winter then. So that summer, there's this crisis over, are we going to war or not? And it's even more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis in some cases. So Kennedy comes under pressure to, how do we respond to this, And Dean Acheson, who wrote that NSC 68 we talked about last time, he says, gives him advice, well, look, declare a state of emergency and increase defense spending and send a bunch of people over to Europe, and we can, jump up the defense spending again just like we did under Truman. And Kennedy calls Eisenhower up, and Eisenhower tells him that would be the dumbest thing you can do, because you look like you're in a panic and you're going to bankrupt the country. That's just stupid. So he ends up compromising and just, makes a bellicose speech and then announces a small increase in defense spending. But along with that, he announces a program to build fallout shelters in government buildings across the country. So I don't know if you ever seen one of these. Some of them, there's still one in the town I live in. Have you ever seen one of these fallout shelters anywhere?
I don't know if I've ever actually seen one in real life. Not that I can think of. I certainly remember Duck and Cover, the cartoon, and all of that.
Well, sometimes sometimes, I mean, I don't, they're not active anymore, but sometimes you'll see a sign for them, like on a get old courthouse building or something that's, you know, was built back then. Well, what's crazy is that those fallout shelters weren't designed to protect people from nuclear explosions. So the idea was that, oh, we're going to bring the air raid siren, you're going to run in here and protect yourself from bombs. They were to protect you from fallout floating from Russia over into the United States. So so the idea that it, what it was a first-strike plan to hit Russians, and then we would just sit in these fallout shelters for a week or two and then come out and, you know, everything would be hunky-dory.
Right, the, so it's not... It's just like with the missile defense, so-called missile defense systems now. It's not really a defensive thing. It's just extra armor for bringing to your aggression.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But the thing is, they presented Kennedy with a plan in the summer 1961. They said, here's our nuclear strike plan. And it was the first strike plan. They just flat out told him, look, we got so many more missiles that there's a good chance we can shoot these missiles off and totally obliterate them, and they wouldn't even be able to harm us at all. And their estimate was, well, even if they do get some sort of response off, it would kill 10 to 20 million American people at most. So that was an acceptable, you know, risk to some people. Apparently, but they also told them that at the rate that we're building missiles, the actually the optimal time to launch an attack like this would be towards the end of 1963 or sometime in 1964. And towards the end of this meeting, Kennedy got angry and left the room and said, "You know, we're not going to do anything like this." Essentially, and that was that. But it just shows you the mentality that people had. And the thing is, during these years, China didn't have a nuclear bomb either until 1965. So they wouldn't be able to respond either. So there's some logic to, you know, MacArthur's desire to, you know, expand his war in Korea into China. And there is a logic, too, behind launching a nuclear war or something before 1965. And I think there's actually a good, well, there is evidence that this is part of the reason the Vietnam War occurred. There's Pentagon histories that are declassified that show in 1964, they presented, Joint Chiefs of Staff presented Lyndon Johnson with a series of scenarios and plans to go to war in Vietnam, not just to defend South Vietnam, but they wanted to attack North Vietnam. And they claim the phrase they use is that they had a nuclear umbrella that would be able to protect our invasion force, you know, in Vietnam. Of course, you know, Johnson didn't do that, and we didn't really escalate Vietnam until 1965. And
by the way, for people who might have missed it, that I believe, Michael, what you're saying, that's newspeak for we're going to do this, and the Russians better not intervene at all, or we'll nuke Moscow.
Yeah, or China.
That's what they mean by we have a nuclear umbrella.
Yeah, yeah, or China. And yeah. I mean, it's just amazing stuff, you know, this history. They have a phrase that I never heard before until right before I put this book out, and that is a coercive nuclear strike. The theory behind that is you nuke Russia, and then you just tell them surrender, and then they'll have to. it's just amazing. So I think all this is an explanation for, you know, when I talk about the Joint Chiefs of Staff, too, I don't want to say all of them thought this at all, but some of them certainly did, especially the ones in the Air Force. But there's plenty of evidence that a few of them were skeptical of this sort of intervening or warmongering, whatever you want to call it. But there were certainly, you know, it's frightening stuff, you know, when you read this. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, for people who are too lazy to do the reading, if you ever see that movie, 13 Days, I'm sure it's all chock full of inaccuracies, but part of it that is certainly right is that there are men who are willing to go ahead and have a nuclear war, even at the expense of American cities. Even, I mean, obviously they were far ahead in their capabilities beyond the USSR, as you say, but they were willing to go ahead and do it for whatever consequences. And by the way, I didn't actually get as far as the Cuban Missile Crisis in your book, so I don't want to go that far, but I would like to hear for at least a little while your telling of the Bay of Pigs disaster here, because, well, it's just been an interest of mine since I was really young for some reason. And I talked with the great Howard Jones, wrote a great book on the Bay of Pigs a couple of years back, who I got a good interview out of him about that. But anyway, just something that's interesting to me and interested for people who they've heard of that, the Bay of Pigs, but they don't know what it is. You do a really great job of retelling the story here, so why don't you fill us in? Is it really something else?
Well, the Bay of Pigs happened as soon, a month or two, it was April of 1961, just months after Kennedy got in office. He launched an invasion of Cuba with 1,000 Cuban exiles. Castro took power in the 50s, and CIA was training these Cuban exiles, and they were in Nicaragua, put them on a couple boats and sent them to Cuba, about 1,000 men, and they were supposed to land there and start a spontaneous revolt and just take over the whole island. That was the plan presented to Kennedy. And if it failed, they told him, well, they can just go into the mountains of Cuba and, you know, they'll be able to turn into a guerrilla army, and eventually they'll win. And of course, what ends up happening is he launches this invasion. As part of the invasion force, there's a couple bombers that are supposed to go over to Cuba and, you know, bomb out Castro's air force and support the invasion fleet. Well, they end up blowing up only half the airplane, so their mission fails, and then this is all supposed to be operation not involving the United States, which of course it is, and not everyone in the government told about it ahead of time. So the ambassador to the United Nations for the U.S. Is told that we have nothing to do with it, and, you know, we have nothing to do with these bombers, and they're just actually Castro people defecting, and this guy Adlai Stevenson, he tells the UN this, and then he finds out, well, the CIA lied to him, and with his cover story, he's telling the world, now he gets mad, you know, because he looks like a fool, and then he complains to McGeorge Bundy, Kennedy's national security advisor. He cancels the airstrikes as a result, and the whole invasion, of course, collapses, and the men surrender, and Castro eventually allows them to come back to the United States under ransom payment that Kennedy pays. It's $30 to $50 million. And the thing about it is, why has this whole stupid operation even happened in the first place? And that's one of the things that Khrushchev tells the Politburo. He basically says, what is this? You know, I can't understand why would the President of the United States launch a stupid invasion like this and let it fail? What in the world, you know, what does this mean? Does this mean Kennedy's incompetent? Or does it mean that this is some sort of trick that Alan Dulles of the CIA has played on him to discredit him or something? Khrushchev just makes no sense out of it. It's one of these, you know, strange events that we were talking about before, but thankfully, there's been plenty of great histories written about it, plenty of records about it and everything, so yeah, I don't really think it is a mystery today, although it certainly would be if you were alive then watching this on television, the news conferences and stuff.
Yeah, well, it's a mess, and, you know, it's funny, the fact that the thing went on, it's just, you know, separate from all the rest of the politics and whatever, it's a curiosity to me. Just, I think even that book, The Perils of Groupthink, was written about the planning for it, where they changed every part of the plan in an ad hoc way at the last minute, and then they still went with it. And everybody knew at some point they had an objection. Now, they didn't all object to the same thing, But they all objected, and they all still went along anyway, and they all still did it anyway. And there wasn't no way in the world. And I mean, you quote them in there saying, oh, that's no coral reef. That's a cloud. Yeah. Well, in other words, it's been decided above my pay grade. And so, you know, I don't have the authority here, basically, to expand on this or change any of this. The bosses want to believe that it's not going to be a problem. And so my job is making sure they keep believing that, basically. And there they all go. You know, the path to hell paved with good intentions. And of course, you know, I couldn't begin to catalog. I don't really understand it well enough to catalog through all the different consequences that came out of that operation. Its attempt and its failure and the rest of it, you know. But I'm sure there were plenty if you had to go trace them back, you know.
Talk about that in a second, because that's really, really important. But the thing is, the whole operation, to start with, originated not as an invasion of Cuba, but it was supposed to be a guerrilla operation where you drop these, you would train these exile people not to land on the beaches, but to parachute into Cuba and set up, you know, sabotage operations and guerrilla stuff, and that's what was intended at first. That's what Eisenhower actually approved, and these operations kept failing. So they would, you know, fly in a crate of guns, parachute the stuff down, and they just wouldn't get to nobody because there was really no one there. And this Richard Bissell guy, who happened to be the same dude that was in charge of the U-2 operation, he was in charge of this too. And he was being groomed to become the CIA director. Alan Dulles was set to retire in a few years, and he was grooming this guy. So he wanted to succeed in Cuba so he could get promoted and be a big shot. So between the presidency of Eisenhower and Kennedy, he just on his own decides, well, I'm going to change this from guerrilla operations that aren't working to let's just do an invasion. So no president approved of changing the operation. He just did it, and then Kennedy gets in. They present him with the new plan that they've, you know, been now working on for 3 or 4 months. And Kennedy kind of doesn't want to do it, and he diddly daddles around for a while, and then he finally does approve it. And Alan Dulles, who was the CIA director, basically tells him, "Look, if you don't do this invasion, then." What are we going to do with the people we've trained in Nicaragua? They're going to go run around, talk, and they're going to get mad or whatever. It's going to come out. So he said, or he said to Kenny, was we have a disposal problem. You know, I don't think he wants these people to die unnecessarily, but he, Dulles later argues that he thought if we invaded Cuba, and even if the invasion failed, that Kennedy would respond with the military and bring in the Marines. And the whole thing, you know, all the details of it, it's just this bureaucratic nightmare. Because here's a military operation, an invasion, like, almost not, it's like D-Day or something, not that big, but it's, you know, a pretty complicated thing. And Joint Chiefs of Staff and the military, they just keep their arms away from it. They don't really want to get involved in the planning. And, you know, it's like the only reason it happens is because these two guys, Dulles and Bissell, you know, wanted to look good or something, and everyone just went along with it. And there's an incredible, like, the one of the things that really stood out to me when I was reading the research and stuff is they have this final meeting where Kennedy is going to decide whether to approve the invasion or not, and he doesn't really ask for a debate or anything. He invites one of the senators, William Fulbright, to come in there, and he speaks out against it, and then everyone just denounces Fulbright. And Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, he supports it. Then later on, he writes in his memoirs that, I was just worried about my own position. I thought it was a bad thing, but I don't want to say anything. Yeah, it's just pretty amazing.
But, yeah. And, you know, the thing is, I can totally relate to that just from having regular day jobs or whatever, where the boss is wrong about something, and yet everybody just goes, well, whatever, okay, and they all look at each other and roll their eyes, and they let it continue on. Only in this case, it's, you know, important stuff that's worth sticking your neck out for, but apparently nobody's any more likely to go ahead and stick their neck out.
Well, you're talking about 100 people, you know, died. You know, 100 of these Cuban exiles died. I'm sure a few people in Cuba died, too. And 1,000 of them, or 900 of them left, became captured.
Well, and it could have become one of these Guns of August kinds of things, too. I mean, they weren't just messing around with nothing here. They were messing around with the relationship between America and the USSR, not just Cuba, you know?
No, it's completely crazy. So the biggest problem, and one of Kennedy's advisors who is against it wrote him a memo saying this, what the problem isn't if it fails, but if it succeeds. Because what will end up happening is you have 1,000 people over there, and now you're going to have a civil war in Cuba, and then we'll have to intervene in that, and now we're bogged down in something, and it's just, you know, a disaster. But the thing is, the long-term consequences of what occurred are very important to the institution of the CIA and the presidency itself, because, first of all, Kennedy launches sort of like a fact-finding investigation into the causes of the failure. He brings in Maxwell Taylor, who is a general that was working under Eisenhower, to personally advise him and sort of like fix the situation and so forth. And they end up, two things end up happening. First of all, they take away the ability to do paramilitary operations out of the hands of the CIA. You know, if you see movies and talk, you know, you see this quote, and I've never seen it anywhere, so I don't think it's real, that Kennedy wanted to destroy the CIA in 1,000 pieces and so forth. That's, I don't think that's really true, but what ends up happening is he just takes the control of doing anything of this magnitude out of the hands of CIA and puts it into Joint Chiefs of Staff. So from then on, in Cuba, a new operation called Mongoose is created to run sabotage missions and try to assassinate Castro and so forth. And that's actually in the hands of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's got CIA people working for it, but, you know, Bissell and Dulles, they're fired, and they're the people that take their place, they're not really under direct control anymore. And the CIA, it just becomes so politically discredited from this Bay of Pigs thing that it just essentially loses its power, and it's, I think, as the decades have gone on, it's just become more and more politically discredited. It's almost, I think, like almost a whipping boy nowadays. But the other thing that happens is that Kennedy himself, you know, he realizes, I've got to have some sort of control over what's going on. I've messed up. I've proved something. I look like a fool. And how does the president rule over what has now become a gigantic national security bureaucracy, a CIA, a Pentagon? Today, you know, there's like 17 intelligence agencies. How can the president manage any of this stuff? And it wasn't a situation a president faced before World War II, you know, when he could, with basically a handful of advisors, do everything that had to be done. Now, the whole government is this giant mushroom, and it's a big question, because what Eisenhower did, and why, one reason I don't think he, no president can probably be in full control over everything, but what Eisenhower would do is hold these National Security Council meetings quite frequently, and there make the decision. And what would happen is people would come to these meetings and basically present him with information they wanted to give him to lead him where they wanted him to go. So that's basically what Alan Dulles would do, is tell him all this stuff. Hey, you know, we got communists in Guatemala or Iran or this and that place. And he would just approve whatever he said. And then he'd get information from someone disgruntled saying, look, this Alan Dulles guy, you know, he's snowballing you sometimes. So that's how I think Eisenhower basically gave the CIA a blank check in all these covert operations. And then on the hands-on stuff, he worked on the military budget and trying to control the arms race, and took a real personal involvement in that. So after the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy decides, well, I'm not going to operate with these big meetings and people just presenting me stuff to approve. He tries to work sort of behind the scenes by having like a person in each place he can trust and talk to and try to get information from them and try to work around the bureaucracy to do certain decisions. But then the problem with that is the president can only do so much and put his hand on one thing at a time. And he spends a lot of time focusing on the Soviet Union and diplomacy with Russia. Him and Robert Kennedy form a back channel network, a communication line to relatives of Khrushchev to communicate with and try to negotiate deals with and so forth. And that actually, the relationship helps them resolve the Cuban Missile Crisis when that breaks open. But one thing that ends up happening is when it comes to the Vietnam situation, Kennedy kind of, you know, sort of ignores it almost for most of its presidency, and the situation deteriorates. It isn't until the very end where he really starts to say, well, I better start to get more involved in this.
Right. Now, it's funny, you know, when you talk about the power of the bureaucracy and all that, the only people, we spoke a little bit about this before, about how it took, you know, Nixon at his drunken rages to be able to take control of the thing. And it seems like the only other person I can think of, I guess you're saying Kennedy, you know, to some degree pushed back, but the only person who was really successful that I know of really controlling the bureaucracy, it seems like, I mean, from what I know anyway, they say he's a legend because he was able to do it. And that's Dick Cheney. He had so many people, he had Washington so wired, he knew who everybody was and what all their connections to each other were and exactly which strings to pull and where to apply pressure. And he had, you know, staffers in the Senate, and he had people in the Pentagon, and he had, you know, everywhere he needed them. He could control the entire state as a unitary executive in a way that I don't know if anybody was ever that successful. I mean, think about their complaints, right? The CIA and the State Department and all the generals that resigned, they realized, like, wow, this guy's got total power over us. We can't stop him, so we quit.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the way, you know, the reason he was able to do that is because he goes back in government to the Ford administration.
Because he was even worse than them.
Yeah.
Because he personifies evil. Oh, sorry.
But he also had an ally in Donald Rumsfeld too, and they were good buddies back in the Ford administration. Which, what was it? Rumsfeld was Secretary of State back then, and Cheney was Chief of Staff, I think it was. And so, I mean, you've got two men that have built up networks for 30 years before they got into the White House or into the Pentagon. So they had all this experience. They had all these contacts and a huge drive to do all this stuff. And you look at Bush, you think he was just over his head.
Yeah. All right. Now, listen, we're out of time basically for today's show. I think we certainly have at least one more interview, maybe two more interviews worth in this thing to go over. Probably one more. So I'm certainly looking forward to that. Before we stop to just tell everybody how to buy the book and all that, which they need to know, talk about the ones that you're working on and how close they are, because this is just the first of two or three.
Well, I'm working on the second one about the Vietnam War, and the idea is the time period is 45 to 1968, and I've written up to the Kennedy administration, so I'm hoping to have that all completed by next year and probably release sometime in 2015. But I'm real excited about that one because this book here, you know, the writing style for this war book, you know, even though I do think it's written really well, it really starts to come in, you know, once you get past the first chapter and a half. And this new book I'm working on, it just really, it's well written throughout, and it's even better than this one. It's got even crazier information about the arms race and the reasons why we escalated in Vietnam. And I'm not sure what direction I'll go in after that. I've considered, you know, writing one about the neoconservative movement in the 70s and 80s.
Well, you know, I almost went off on a tangent about that, about how Wolstetter, who was Paul Wolfowitz's inspiration, you know, gained all his power and influence as a nuclear warfare theorist, and you know, how might we be able to actually go ahead and use these things? Like Mr. Burns complains on The Simpsons, these do-nothing nuclear weapons that just sit around all day. We need to figure out how we can use them and live to use them again sometime, some other time. So anyway, yeah, I would very much like to read your treatment of that, who those kooks are, where they come from, and why they hate America so much. Anyway, we got to go. We're all out of time, but I hope next Monday, same time?
Yeah, sure. That'd be great.
Okay, great. That's Michael Swanson, everybody, author of The War State. Go out and get it, or sit right where you are right now and Google it and get it. It's at Amazon. You can click the link from my website. Thanks, Mike. See y'all tomorrow. Hey.